From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Kim Lewis, co-host of Africa News Tonight. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Reva Levinson, founder, president, and CEO of KRL International, a lobbying firm based in Washington. She's also the author of the book Choosing the Hero, My Improbable Journey and the Rise of Africa's First Woman President. That person is none other than Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is also a Nobel Peace Laureate. President Johnson Sirleaf governed Liberia for 2 6-year terms and is stepping down this month, consistent with the country's constitution. What is less well known is Reva Levinson's role in helping the Iron Lady, as Sirleaf is affectionately known, to achieve this milestone. In Choosing the Hero, Reva Levinson chronicles her behind-the-scenes lobbying for Sirleaf, who went on to win the presidency in 2005 and the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. We also gain keen insights into the pluck and courage of Reva, who deftly navigated the ruthless world of Washington lobbyists. In addition to her beloved Liberia, Reva takes us to war-torn Somalia in 1989, to Angola during the aborted elections in 1992, to Baghdad after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, to Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, and the list of danger zones goes on and on. Prior to founding KRL, Reva Levinson served as managing director at BKSH and Associates, now the Prime Policy Group, and before that, she was hired by none other than Paul Manafort of the firm Black, Manafort, Stone & Kelly. That was Washington's very first bipartisan lobbying firm. Yes, it's the same Paul Manafort who was recently indicted on 12 counts, including money laundering and conspiracy against the United States in connection with the probe of Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Reva Levinson has traveled to over 50 countries throughout her career and has managed projects of consequence in Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, South Asia, and Europe. We'll talk with her about her extraordinary journey and how and why she persevered in championing her hero, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Reva Levinson joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Reva, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Kim Lewis.
Thanks so much again. I am very happy to be here.
Well, Reva, first of all, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
It's your life, really. What was the impetus for writing this book, which is in part an homage to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, but also part autobiography, as if the two of you were sort of interchangeable?
Well, first of all, the book, even though it came out last year, it took me about 13 years to put together. So it was a labor of love and a commitment that I made to myself. But the impetus was three-part. One was, Carol, as you know, I've been doing this type of traveling around the world almost for 3 decades. And I've been to the places you identified and other places you haven't. And I was on the front line of history, and I witnessed so much. I witnessed a lot of people who didn't live to fight another day. And so this book, for me, was trying to make sense of my journey, what I saw, the decisions that were made, almost to judge myself and to judge what I had contributed. The second reason I wrote the book is I wanted people to know Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Like you said, the first woman democratically elected to lead an African nation, a Nobel laureate, but I didn't want them to understand her successes or the triumphs, but I wanted them to understand the humanity of this woman who, when everything was against her, and I met her in 1996, gave up her job, her position in the U.S., her pension, and returned to Africa, to Liberia, to fight warlords and try to bring peace and democracy to her country. So I wanted people to see her struggle because, you know, the struggle is the essence of all of us, and it's also my struggle. The third thing I wanted to do, and it's maybe the Paul Manafort piece of the book, is that I wanted to lift the curtain, and I wanted people to see what happens in Washington and see what happens behind the scenes and to look at the drivers.
Well, it's certainly an inspiring book, and I will say for full disclosure that
We have known each other, although our paths diverted over the last two decades, because I was involved in Africa myself for many years. And it's a pleasure to see you again and to read your extraordinary journey. Now I'd like to turn to my colleague Kim for a question.
Well, you shared your experiences knowing and even working with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So, of course, you know that one of her biggest qualities is her strength. What would you say are some of her other qualities that really other women can look up to so that they can accomplish their goals? They may not want to be president of a country or even a company, but many women are working, especially in Africa. The majority of farmers in Africa are women. Mm-hmm. So what types of qualities does Mrs. Sirleaf exude that they could look up to outside of the strength that we see on the outside?
It's a great question. I'm going to start with, I think, one of her best quotes, which she says that if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough. And so she herself had her own dream, which was to bring peace and democracy to her country. And it scared her. She almost lost her life for it, but she kept focused and she kept going. And one of the things that she says when she meets people is she wants people, in addition to the day-to-day struggle, to capture something that they want for themselves and their family and to put it out front and to just keep going after it. So I think the drive and the passion and the imagination is something that she brings. The other thing that I would say is that even though she's so focused on the goals and the values that define her, she knew how to compromise. And so she knew how to take people with her. And sometimes you have to move a little back to go more forward. And I think one of the things that Liberia will realize when she leaves is that that skill, that ability to maneuver, that ability to not always get your way, but to know that you have to take other paths to come forward, might be one of the greatest assets that she had as a post-conflict leader. And then the other thing I would say, and all of us are women, we're all moms, is the fact that that always was a part of her essence. Her attachment to her children and her family and her grandchildren and her nieces and her nephews was something that always grounded her in what was essential and important.
And Reeve, of course, you were greatly inspired by her. Throughout your career, you never gave up, even though you had to represent less savory characters. We'll get into that later. But you were also very much inspired by and influenced by your grandmother, Oma. You had a very difficult childhood, as your book chronicles. You surmounted so many challenges valiantly. I'd like you to talk about the role of your maternal grandmother, Oma, how she was sort of a touchstone for you and how she also gave you strength in times of despair and uncertainty.
Well, thank you for allowing me to talk about my Oma. My Oma, my grandmother, was Manya Pachter Kroner, and she was born in 1900 in Lithuania, then moved to Berlin, and she became a medical doctor in Germany as a woman and as a Jew. So was a remarkable accomplishment, but she ended up fleeing. She fled to New York with my mother and my aunt, and the rest of her family perished. And so her struggle, her fight, the fact that she achieved so much as a woman and being discriminated against was something that I always wanted to honor. So she was the rock in a family that was, as you know from Choosing the Hero, a bit dysfunctional, but families, you know, are dysfunctional by their nature. So she always drove me to want to leave something behind and want to make good of the sacrifice that she and her family made. And so what the book does is introduces my maternal grandmother as almost my spiritual guidance, but she passes away and I'm a bit adrift. And you see my life just going from which way and doing things, as you said, unsavory characters, things that I couldn't self-justify. And when I meet Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in 1996, and I see this woman who represents these ideals of democracy and governance and wanting to go and fight for her country and give it all up, it's almost like I was able to take what I felt for my grandmother and almost project it onto Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and I just became connected to her. I don't think I've said that before, but I think in the book you kind of feel that. So, you know, she was kind of the foundation, and maybe in Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, I saw a lot of my grandmother.
And indeed, you know, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in the foreword to your book says, "I encourage everyone to read this book. It tells my story from the special perspective of a woman who knows me well, that's you, Reva, and was with me at every stage of the journey, a woman to whom I will always be grateful. But read this book also for the reason that it is as much Reva's story as it is mine." And that I found very fascinating as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I can really relate to what you're saying with your grandmother. My father was very passionate about helping people and civil rights. Mm-hmm. And he was the first African-American head of the Baltimore Teachers Union in Baltimore City. So I can kind of relate to that. And when he did pass away, someone said to me, I said, "What am I going to do? My dad, he's gone now, and I am really going to miss him." And the person who was his brother, my uncle, said, "Well, don't miss him, be him." And that way you can kind of keep their legacy going.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. We're talking with Reva Levinson, founder, president, and CEO of KRL International, a lobbying firm based in Washington, and author of Choosing the Hero, My Improbable Journey and the Rise of Africa's First Woman President. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Kim Lewis, co-host of Africa News Tonight. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Dennis Agada, our loyal listener from Kaduna State in northern Nigeria. Thanks for your feedback, Dennis. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're back to our special guest, Reva Levinson. And Reva, I do want to get into, you know, the challenges of being a lobbyist, having ideals, but having to make a living. And you quote in the book, you said here, "I have to believe in what I'm doing, and I have to believe it's something for the good. That's ingrained in my psyche. It is also what Paul Manafort predicts will be my downfall in this business." So right there we have this contradiction in the business of lobbying. So how did you reconcile your idealistic impulse, this desire to represent clients, particularly in Africa and the developing world like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, with the financial necessity sometimes of representing less than savory clients like autocrats, like Obiang of Equatorial Guinea, who can pay any price for your services?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's the line of the book. I do want your listeners to know that the book and the chapters on Manafort and even that small comment there, that was put together more than a decade ago. So it wasn't a convenient way of reviewing what's happened now. Trump was still at Trump Towers and Paul Manafort was somewhere off in Ukraine. But what I use Paul Manafort in the book, it's not about poor Manafort, and I promise I'll answer your question, is that I started in a place in my life where somebody else was directing me, and I had all of these projects. I was deployed to Mogadishu, I was deployed to Angola, Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Kashmir, Philippines, and I always convinced myself that when I got there and I knew what the mission is, that I could make a difference. It would be better because I was there. And that was how I kept going. I think that's how a lot of my colleagues kept going on these difficult missions, because it's not like your boss sits behind you. You know, they put you on a plane and they airdrop you, you know, into the middle of a conflict zone. So I think that's how I kept myself going. But what I'm going to do, though, is say I open the book with Paul and with Somalia because it's a dark place for me as a person. I'm going into Mogadishu when the rebels are closing in on the city and trying to navigate my way out and speaking to a dictator and trying to convince him to hire us. And so it's, can you get any lower than that? So the book starts off in a low place. And what you see the book do is I climb out of that. And I climb out of that with my own self-realization that if I stick to this path, I'm not going to be Oma's granddaughter. And that's why when I meet Ellen Johnson Sirleaf And there's a great scene in Choosing the Hero, and you know this, Carol, is that I meet her because I'm taking in Teodoro Obiang of Equatorial Guinea to explain to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's then head of the United Nations in Africa, that the election that he just won, 98.5%, was really okay, and that he would do better the next time. And there was democracy and governance. And what I saw in Ellen when I was meeting with her was the fact that I was on the wrong side of the table, and I wanted to be sitting with her. And that's my pivot point in the book.
That's a very beautiful story, I have to say. Let me turn to my colleague, Kim, for another question.
Well, I was just going to bring up, in looking at the news lately, and some of the big issues today are, as we all know, are sexism, sexual harassment, and a lot of it in the workplace that women are facing. And it's just coming out every day. You see something new, something different. However, when you do look at the continent of Africa, you don't hear a whole lot about that. And as I mentioned before, it's such a vast continent with so many different countries that have different cultures. So when you look at it from that perspective, where would you start for African women to try to even to bring attention to it?
It's a great question. And what I wanted to do, if it's okay with you, Carol, is as I write a column for The Hill, and in the last column that I write, I talk about Africa needing its own Me Too moment. Sexual violence actually is a deep-rooted issue, but I talk about something different. I talk about the ingraining of misogyny and sexism that allows women to come to a particular place in politics but not get to that ultimate place of a real threat to power and entrenched interest in patriarchy. And I talk about the need to address that from a fundamental obstacle to democracy. And it's something that I feel deeply about. Sexual violence is, because of conflict, is so rooted in Africa. There's so much discussion about that, but there's not a lot of discussion about the cruelty that women face. And the fact that an ambitious political woman in Africa is still more likely to be scorned than to be celebrated.
Yes, that is really true. And just even here in the United States, there was just a program on recently, even some of the African-American women who are in the entertainment industry were saying they were not themselves taken seriously in that same light in terms of sexism and sexual harassment. So it's something that's real, like you said, it's very, very deep-rooted.
I think so. And one of the things that I have never really accepted, maybe until this Me Too moment. So I had my own Me Too moment last year when The Conversation came out and when Time Magazine issued its, you know, Person of the Year, the people who break the silence. Because when I go back in my mind as I'm a writer through my career and just realizing how tough it was and how much grief I took, but that I just felt it was part and parcel of everything else that you have to deal with, like in my line of work as being a woman in the international field, like bad hotels or misplanes or malaria-infested mosquitoes and sexism and all of that. I just kind of put it in that same package of, I got this. Do you know I got this? But when you step back and you look at it, I mean, even I was writing some of the stuff down, like being in Nairobi in a bar with my colleagues and a Brit coming over and asking them, why is she here and what does she do? And they like look and they, oh, she's our safe sex. And they ha, 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 ha. And you're just like, well, you know, that's just what I take. And when I go back and I look at those early times, I just realize how much of that I took, but that I felt it was the price I paid for my profession. I didn't single it out. You know, like it's being singled out today. So it's something I'm going back and just trying to explore.
It's a very important thing to do. And again, I encourage people to read your book. It's very brave. And it explains, it illustrates what a difficult profession you embarked on. And it's very interesting that in 2006, you know, after Ellen Johnson Sirleaf addressed the U.S. Congress, that you started rethinking your career, and you decided that after 10 years of working for Black Manafort, Stone & Kelly, and then the subsequent firm that came after that, that you needed to embark on your own path and open your own firm. That was a very brave decision, very risky. What prompted you to take this risk and strike out on your own?
Ellen's victory, President Sirleaf's victory. Because, you know, I said earlier that you're working for other people and you're never an owner of your own decision and you're always making compromises, and those compromises are for others. But I think when I saw her victory and what was possible, I wanted to make my own decisions and have a company where I could feel good about the projects that I was working on. So I took a deep breath and I cashed in all my stock and made sure that I had all of my emails in my files. And I left. And, you know, being a small business is tough, and wanting to mentor people and being a woman, but it's the best thing that I did. And it brought me to my book, and it brought me back to you.
Well, Reva, what about your assessment of the continent as we speak, you know, Africa? Where things stand in general in terms of equitable economic development, the things that you champion, political freedom, freedom of speech? Of course, we're seeing, you know, creeping terrorism, you know, offshoots of the so-called Islamic State, the byproduct of the collapse of Libya, the conflict in Mali, and now Boko Haram in Nigeria. These are all very troubling developments. What's your assessment throughout these long years of your career?
Well, first I'll say that I'm an Africa optimist. And after working in 30 years and seeing from where the continents come, you know, I feel that's the right place to be, and I maintain that. But I was just speaking with a group of students at Syracuse University, and, you know, one of the young people raised their hand and said, what's the most important ingredient in Africa going forward? And I, Carol, think it's leadership. And it's one of the things that I've learned in working with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, because you can have the resources and you can have the international community on your side, but if you don't have a leader that's committed to moving the country forward, grounded in democracy, rule of law, and free market, but with a recognition that there needs to be some type of base of support for society. And if you don't have good leaders, you don't have anything. And I think one of the things that I might be looking at, and as I look at KRL going into the next 5 years, is finding those leaders and helping them succeed. Because I do think that is the greatest challenge right now. I do believe that democracy is a huge passion of the young people, and the young people want it, but I think there's still so many obstacles to it. And if we can break that barrier and give the young people the opportunity to participate and to believe in the system and have leaders that can take that energy and invest it into the country, then we have the future of the continent. You know, we're seeing some really great examples. I think we'll see that in Ghana in the coming years. In terms of leadership, in terms of policies that are based upon development, in terms of a strong commitment to fight corruption.
Speaking of corruption, how do you see Angola going forward with the new election, new leadership? Are you optimistic about Angola's future?
I'm not so closely following it, but if you look at the new leader, even though the election was kind of an election, and it was a foregone conclusion, it seems to be that the leadership is listening, that change is required, and that it can't be a dynastic rule, and that there has to be development. I'm hoping that social media in Africa becomes a driver for people's opinions to be heard and responded to.
What about the role of China, which is really very aggressive now in the continent, and not always in a very positive way, we know? They're certainly overshadowing U.S. influence, it seems. And I'm wondering what kind of nefarious impact you think this will have on, for example, democracy, free speech, because these are not tenets of the Chinese.
No, they're not. And I think you hit on it, Carol. I think that that's the question. The question is the attractiveness of China as the ability to invest and to bring finance into the economy, but also not take away the values that I still feel Africa is steeped in, which is democracy.
What other impediments do you see in the way of Africa's evolution and progress in the coming decade?
I mean, I think everybody's got their list, but I think conflict and conflict mitigation. I think leaders, legacy leaders who have refused to let go and find new ways to stay in power, they just all have to go. Then we have the issue of this huge demographic of young people that if they are not provided opportunity and an opportunity to contribute to themselves and their family and the country, they're going to be a huge burden in terms of crime, a burden in terms of migration, a burden in terms of the concerns of terrorism. And then maybe something that I fundamentally believe after watching post-conflict Liberia is just the importance of education and being able to provide young people the opportunity with knowledge, and that knowledge being translated into skill, and that skill being translated into job and then development. I mean, that's the critical cycle. That's also the cycle that's erupted when you have bad governance and corruption.
How do you see the role of the United States vis-a-vis Africa? Are you concerned about this current administration and the tendency to want to sort of withdraw the so-called America First policy, which means that we will have fewer diplomats or fewer economic development programs or less investment in Africa?
That's a great question. I mean, it's a deep concern. If you look at the administration in December, released their national security strategy, and if you look at the page on Africa, it's two pages, and it never mentions democracy or human rights in the strategy. And it does focus on those things that we believe in, like governance and development, but you get a sense that there's not this understanding of the vital link that America has played in Africa in guiding transitions and policy and development. And it does not feel at current time that this administration, you know, recognizes the impact that it can have. If you look at Africa, it's really interesting. People are really jaded about democracy now around the world, in Asia, in the US, in Europe. They're like, how can this happen in democracy? But if you poll Africa, Africa has the greatest majority of people who are unwavering in their belief if you make a commitment to an open society, good things will happen. And the concern I have about America is that driver doesn't seem to be there in this administration, not yet. And I think in 2018 and this year, you're going to see a lot of that if the administration, this Trump administration, doesn't step up and lead on a continent that's still willing to follow us, that the Congress will likely do that.
And you and I know, Reva, as you just mentioned, how much Africans are just drawn to the United States. It's just a natural affinity, an affection, perhaps because we don't have a colonial legacy. But I found that in the management of scholarship programs when I was doing that in the late 80s. And I still think that that exists today, this natural affection for the United States. And it wouldn't take much for us to capitalize on that.
I completely agree. And so if the administration, for whatever policy reasons, decides it's not going to play that role, I think it's going to be incumbent on Congress and everyone else to come and to step into that. So there's this tiny part in my book. It's the last paragraph of the afterword, and it sums up where I landed, and I couldn't write it until I went through the whole journey, and I'm wondering if I can just read that for your listeners.
That would be terrific. Absolutely.
So this is it. So working with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has taught me to follow my heart and not to fear being misunderstood. I have come to see that certainty is a luxury and destiny a journey that reveals itself with time. It's easy to stray off course, to doubt and to lose faith, to see compromise as surrender, to feel judged, isolated, even abandoned, but there's always something to hold on to, the belief that things will get better, and the belief in yourself. I've come to appreciate that we need people to guide us, those we admire, those we believe in, the heroes that we choose.
The book is Choosing the Hero, My Improbable Journey and the Rise of Africa's First Woman President. The author, Reva Levinson, founder, president, and CEO of KRL International. Reva, congratulations, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Cornelius Tenner. And joining me on the program was Kim Lewis, co-host of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.